Hello, this is Joya Spadafora, and I am interviewing Professor Henry Truhl as part of the Art History at 100 Oral History Program. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Joya.
Would you mind talking a little bit about when you came to UW-Madison?
Yes, I had been teaching at Cleveland State University in Cleveland, Ohio. It was a new state university to serve an urban community, and I'm from an urban background. I come from the Republic of Brooklyn in New York City, and that was my first employment after finishing graduate school at Columbia University. Being a new state university, it was not to repeat other graduate PhD programs in other state campuses. So we were only able to develop a master's program in art history, but not a PhD. And while I enjoyed my stay there and my teaching and my students and the curatorial work that I did, I wasn't able to see students through to a terminal degree. The best ones could do a master's with me, and then I had to say goodbye to them when I didn't want to say goodbye to them. And so the opportunity to apply for a university that had a PhD program in art history was something that I was interested in. And I had taught there. I had had other opportunities, but decided against them because I was at Cleveland State for 17 years, on and off. I mean, I had grants that took me overseas, but I was there for quite a bit of time. And then when the position at Wisconsin was advertised, I was very interested in it. So I applied and came to interview here. I was one of the finalists. And my visit here was something that convinced me that this is where I wanted to be. I liked the colleagues that I met both in art history and Afro-American studies because this was put together as a joint appointment between those two departments. And I can talk about that, the pluses and the minuses of joint appointments. But that interested me, and also the fact that the art history department was in the then Elvium Museum of Art, and that art history and exhibitions and museum work were two things that were integrated here on this campus. And that was something that I had done at Cleveland State University. So it was something I wanted to continue. I had been also the curator of African art, a consulting curator of African art at the Cleveland Museum of Art in the last 3 or 4 years that I was there. And I enjoyed that very much. So it looked like Wisconsin was the right kind of fit for the things that I was interested in and continuing to work on. My public talk as part of the interview process, I thought went well, and I got lots of positive response from colleagues, my future colleagues. But there was one graduate student who actually had some very critical comments to make about my presentation. And it kind of took me aback. But at the same time, it also kind of reinforced my understanding that this was a serious university. It was a serious research institution. And that I was going to have to make sure that my game was at the top of its run, so to speak. So I came away from that talk because of the discussion. A number of people supported what I said, but there was still this question that had been raised by a graduate student here in the Department of Afro-American Studies that made me think deeply and wonder whether I was going to be given the offer. Well, the offer did come, and I was very pleased that it did. And it was an offer that I couldn't refuse because it put together the joint appointment. In addition, it provided me with an endowed chair, the E.B.U. Bascom Chair, which added research funds on an annual basis for my work, and the promise of being able to do curatorial work at the Elvium, now the Chazen. So all of those things came together, and there was no question that I wouldn't accept the position, because then I could work with graduate students to PhD level. And the only drawback was that it was taking me to a climate that was even colder than Cleveland. And I have spent many years in Africa, and I think that's affected my my body resistance to cold. So I had to think about that, but it wasn't a serious matter. I said I'll manage, but I would have liked something in a warmer climate. And I've been trying to convince administrators at this university ever since that they should have their long break during the winter and have us teach during the summer here in Wisconsin, or at least do something more substantial in the summer months. But nothing ever came of it. Anyway, I came to Wisconsin, and I had known about the University of Wisconsin before coming here. I knew about Madison. I'm of the generation of the 60s. So I'm a product of an era of the Vietnam War and civil rights. And that's been a big and important part of my education and my growing up, my political awareness and my engagement in political issues, political and social issues. While I was at Columbia, I participated in protests and in the occupation of buildings when we closed down Columbia University at the same time that Madison students did the same here on this campus, and the students at Berkeley did the same thing. That was a watershed moment. And I remembered when I was being recruited to come to Wisconsin about that era and about this university's tradition of progressive politics and political engagement in social justice issues. Those were some of the things that made me want to come here and to join this institution. So all of those things came together in a very positive way, and I was very excited to come. I came in the middle of the academic year. I didn't come in September of 1990, but I started in January of 91. And the reason I came in January was because an important exhibition that I had curated had come to the Cleveland Museum of Art that fall, in the fall of 1990, and I was the one in charge of all of the local programming and the opening and everything around it. It was the exhibition called Yoruba, 9 Centuries of African Art and Thought. So I wanted to see that through to its conclusion before coming here to Madison. So I arrived here in January, in the throes of a Wisconsin winter. but I had a comfortable place to stay. I had found something during the summer before, and still live in that same condo complex today. So that was a good find, and settled in and began my teaching, and was welcomed warmly by my colleagues in both art history and Afro-American studies.
So I know that Watrous saw the need for an Africanist for a long time. When you came to this program, were there expectations that you were informed of in advance about those, his thoughts for this need? Or were you welcome to UW, feel free to be an Africanist and a professor, an art history professor, however you wished? Or were there certain expectations?
Well, if there were expectations, none of those were communicated to me. I was pretty much given free rein to develop the program as I wished. Watrous may have had that in mind, but it was his legacy, and it was the current faculty who were the ones who took the initiative. And it was a number of my colleagues in Afro-American studies who pushed for it. Because that department, Afro-American Studies, again, comes out of this 1960s civil rights movement. And one of the few departments of Afro-American Studies that gives a degree. The efforts in other universities turned those into programs rather than departments. So they were core courses, they were a series of courses, but they weren't constituted as a degree-granting department. That's what happened here at Wisconsin, and that's crucial. That's a crucial difference because programs come and go. Departments don't, or usually they don't. So there was a strength and a commitment on the part of my Afro-American studies colleagues to develop that program, and my colleague, Frida Tesfagorgas, was here. She was one of the founders of that department. And it was she and I who essentially created the field of African and African diaspora arts. So we didn't want to conflict with each other. She had her interests. She would teach the courses in African-American art history. I had taught one at Cleveland, but it was much better for her to teach that course here. And she was interested in women artists, both African-American and contemporary African women artists. And so she developed the African-American art history course and women in the arts, both in this country and in Africa, and she had a special interest in contemporary African art. Whereas my strengths, my background, my focus has often been in the classical arts of Africa, the early traditions, coming up to the 20th century, but contemporary art was not my strength at that point. So that's the way we divided it up. And then on diaspora issues, Frida would take care of the African-American, North American area, and then I, in my diaspora, would do the cultures and the countries where I have done work, that is Brazil especially, then Cuba, Panama, Mexico, Puerto Rico. These are all places where African peoples have come and created and transformed their culture and their artistic traditions. So we had a very nice fit. It worked out perfectly. We could cover the global presence of African artists in the things that we specialized in and knew about. So all of that was good in the transition to Wisconsin. All of that went smoothly. And the relationship with the Chazen was also a good one, where I could build on a small collection that already existed, and then I could begin to either bring exhibitions, traveling exhibitions on African art or African diaspora arts. It was the moment when all of that could be expanded, and so I felt very grateful to be here and to have the resources that I needed to make that happen. Maybe you want me to talk about joint appointments.
I would love to hear about that.
Okay. Joint appointments can be great and they can be terrible. This one turned out to be great. You know, because you have a joint appointment, and my joint appointment was, it wasn't 50-50. That might have made things more difficult. My joint appointment is, well, just that the where your base is and who you have to work with more closely is unclear. So that each, if it's a 50-50 appointment, both departments expect you to be 150% with them. That's the challenge with joint appointments. But it was clear from the beginning that the bulk of my work would be through art history. So it's a three-quarter art history, one-quarter Afro-Am. That is, I teach one intro course on an annual basis for Afro-Am and three courses through art history.
Is the whole position endowed or just the three quarters in the art history?
No, the whole position. It's an endowed chair position, whether you have an appointment in one department or two or three. It's an honorific and substantive endowed chair that provides $10,000 to $12,000 a year for research expenses, travel, equipment, whatever it might be, support for graduate students, because I've used lots of those funds to support my PhD and MA students with, project positions or research assistant positions. So, so this one worked out. This was a good joint appointment because the balance was clear to everybody involved. I would attend Afro-Am faculty meetings and contribute the way I could, but the basic service was mostly for art history department. I like the difference in the personalities and the approaches of my colleagues. Art historians have their own way of working. How would I describe them? I think they're sometimes too serious and not playful enough about their work. I don't know if that's the right way to explain it, but they're more into their heads and their intellect rather than what I've come to understand as a multisensorial experience about life and how that can shape what we write about and how we understand it. So my colleagues in Afro-Am, for example, Frida is a practicing artist as well as an art historian when she was here. She didn't have a terminal degree in art history, but it was her studio background that helped to inform her teaching, okay? Now, some of my colleagues in art history may be practicing artists, but I never hear about that. I consider myself both a practicing artist and an art historian. That is, I make things, and I'm also a dancer.
What kind of dance?
I'm a salsero. I dance salsa. And that's why I like to hang out in Cuba and Puerto Rico and other places in the Latin American world. And it's that combination of both body knowledge and mind or intellect that has shaped my approach that I'll talk about called senseiotics, the study, crucial role of the senses in our multisensorial experiences that we have even before we come into this world, those things that we're experiencing in our mother's wombs, tastes, motions, smells, all of those things are starting to shape us. And I think those sensory experiences are things that art historians and material culture folks and visual culture folks need to remember. Vision is one of the senses that's very important. It gets privileged, but all of those other senses are operating, even though we may not be conscious of them. Okay? So it's a kind of holistic approach that I deal with. When I talk about myself as an art historian, I say, no, I'm an arts historian, because I'm interested in performance, ritual, festival, ceremony, dance, music, sound, choreography, all of those things, smells, tastes, touches, all of those things, as they affect us as what anthropologists would call expressive culture. That's the arts, okay? So the fact that that's the approach that feels right to me, my colleagues in Afro-American studies are often people who are practicing artists and or interested in those other things, like Sandy Adele, who teaches theater, African-American theater, who is an actor herself, who is a director of theater, who is a poet, writes, and there Frida, who was a visual artist, and Craig Werner, who's an incredibly knowledge about African-American music, past, present, and future. You know, so these are folks who had the kinds of sense abilities that I very much appreciated. Not to say that my art history colleagues didn't, but that seems to be more suppressed. You know, what dominates is the word, the way you write about the arts, and the dominance of the sense of sight in art history, which is to be expected. Because art history, what is it? It's words about images. So we learn to use words to describe and to express the impact of visual forms. But as I've suggested in my approach in senseiotics, I said that in order to really capture sensory experience, which is often an experience that is beyond words, our writing has to be poetic. It has to try to attain the level of expressiveness that the arts provide for us. So in my writing, I try to be poetic, as poetic as I can, to evoke those experiences and those feelings, those emotions that are often beyond words. Yoruba culture, that is kind of the fundamental basis, foundation of my work, because I've lived among Yoruba people for probably more than 8 years of my life. At various times, the Yoruba have an expression for that. When something astonishes them, they say, "Oya mileno, oya mileno," which means literally, "It's something that makes my jaw drop." You see the expression on my face? You can't see it on this audio recording, but it's those things that wow us, that make us speechless. That's what I'm trying to get at, because that's what arts do. The most profound arts are the ones that do that to us. Either, you know, they repel us, they frighten us, or they inspire us deeply. That's what senseiotics is trying to get at in the work that I'm writing. So, the personalities and the approaches of my colleagues in both departments have helped to shape me. They've made it a really full and meaningful experience, and I have learned from both of them.
Have those personalities been pretty stable, or have the department's personality changed since you've been at UW?
They've pretty much continued. I mean, you know, my colleagues have come and gone, but each one of them had something to contribute to my growth and my experiences here. For example, let me tell you a little bit about Narciso Menocal, who was my colleague for many years. Narciso is a Cuban. He comes from a very privileged and powerful family in Cuba. And Cuban society and Cuban culture is a strange and very complex thing, just as American culture is, all cultures are. And it has this special complexity on issues of race that are similar yet different from issues of race and color and racism in this country. So Narciso comes from a very privileged background, and his specialty was Frank Lloyd Wright. He was a scholar of Frank Lloyd Wright and knew that material beautifully, and that was, and architecture has also been an interest of mine from a long time ago. I'm kind of a frustrated architect. I thought of going into architecture before art history, but the science and the engineering of it dissuaded me. So now what I do is I make funky bird houses. That's my architectural practice.
How long have you been doing that?
Oh, for maybe about 15, 20 years now. You can go onto my website and see my funky birdhouses. So Narciso and I had lots of conversations about architecture, about issues of race, both in Cuba and in this country. And we also shared an interest in Cuban music. So we would often exchange CDs or names of bands and share our music. And he told me about one Cuban singer whose name, his nickname was Bola de Nieve, which means a ball of snow. Okay? Think of a ball of snow. And then think of Bola de Nieve. He was the blackest of Cuban singers. And that was his nickname. You know, so there's this play on color. This man who is as black as coal, yet a ball of snow. Beautiful balladeer singer. And he was a great favorite of Narciso, and he's become a favorite of mine. In fact, I was listening to one of his records last night and thinking about Narciso. So we would have conversations, because being a Cuban, he also knew about Afro-Cuban culture. He knew about Yoruba faith and practice, the various Yoruba gods and goddesses that are honored in Cuba. But it you know, it's a kind of underground faith, and it's been suppressed. It had to go underground, and then it was celebrated at a certain point, and then because it was a religion, it came in conflict with socialist philosophy during the era of Fidel Castro. And then Narciso and I had very different attitudes about Fidel and socialism and the positives and the negatives, because his family was one that was essentially dispossessed when the revolution came, because they were privileged white Cubans. And so we couldn't talk very much about Cuban politics, because that was something that was very emotional for him, understandably, because he knew what had happened to members of his family. But I always felt that a socialist approach to society, whether in Cuba or in this country, is something that is needed, especially now in this era of neoliberal capitalism, which is out of control. We would talk about art, we would talk about Cuban culture and music and the visual arts, and we even talked about doing a joint seminar, but one that would not deal with any kind of political issues. So we talked about it and planned it, but never did have a chance to do it. So that's, you know, something just to give you an example of kind of the kinds of conversations and exchanges that I had with one of my art history colleagues.
So you've mentioned Madison as far as being socially active in activism. Has that changed during the time you've been here? Have you seen Madison students participating in modern activism the way you expected them to?
Yes, I think I have. But I think, you know, over the 28, 29 years that I've been here, of course, things have shifted and issues have shifted. But I think there's still a fundamental interest and commitment to social justice issues and to progressive politics among the students, among the faculty, in the institution itself. And I've always been pleased to be a part of that and to see its efforts. I think the forces of conservatism and regressive politics are also very strongly there. I mean, I think Madison is not typical of much of the state, and we've seen that in the recent battles between the Republican government and governor in its attitudes and actions toward the university, where I think the university has been a kind of beacon of hope and inspiration for so many people, not just in Wisconsin, but beyond. And I think the university has tried, I think, to live up to its Wisconsin idea. This is something that appealed to me all of these years that I've been here. You know, to say that this university serves all of the citizens of Wisconsin and by extension, the globe, you know, so that as a founding and foundational principle is and always has been important to me. Before the Margaret Center and its what was it called originally? It was kind of like service learning. It was service learning projects. Now it's called something else. It's community education. But even before they started the service learning projects, encouraging students in classes to do projects within the community here at Madison or beyond, I was doing that with my students. I always have, and up until the present still do, an element in my intro classes that gives them the option of doing extra credit projects that are community-based, where they'll go out and tutor or teach words from an African language or bring kids to the museum to see the African art collection. Relating what they're learning in the class and sharing it with others in the community. So I've been doing that for a long time, even before the formalization of that program here at the university. And I always felt the support. I always had the support, moral and financial support for these kinds of programs. I've been successful with lots of grants and bringing guest speakers to deal with these kinds of issues. And yeah, it's been a very positive experience. I think UW-Madison's a great institution, and hopefully it will continue to do the kind of work that it's been doing all along.
Are there any strengths or programs that you think the university and the department should really emphasize on?
Well, I mean, all of them are important in their own way. I mean, for me, one of the other things that was very attractive and brought me to Wisconsin was the presence and the strength of the African Studies program. The African Studies program is the second oldest in the country. The first was established at Northwestern University in Evanston by Melville Herskovitz, very famous Africanist and African-Americanist. And the second to be established was here on campus. Jan Van Sina and others were the founding members of it. And it continues to be a very strong program. I think there are something like maybe 50, 60, I don't know what the number is now, faculty in all schools, in all disciplines who have done work in Africa or have connections with programs in Africa. So it's a vital program, and it's one of the ones that I have been affiliated with since the beginning.
Has the size of that program at UW changed dramatically since?
I think it has. I think it's gotten a little bit smaller, but it's still pretty active. And some of that, of course, has been influenced by changing priorities at the national level, you know, governmental level, because African Study Program is supported with Title VI funding. That's the way they survive. It provides funds for the teaching of African languages and cultural courses. It funds faculty research work and travel. It's crucial. If you don't get the Title VI funding, life becomes very difficult. And this university has been able to have it renewed on a continual basis. But the competition is tough because there are only a few African studies programs on major campuses that are funded. We've been successful with that, and I hope they will continue to be successful. That's been another important element. And in my work on diaspora, because I deal with the global presence of African arts and artists, my affiliations with other area studies programs have also been important, like Latin American, Caribbean, and Iberian studies, the LACIS program. So I'm affiliated with that, and also the South Asian program, South Asian studies program, because I've done work in India, in South Asia, on the descendants of African people there. And you know, so it's been great. You know, African artists have shaped the world. They're present in so many places. It's given me a kind of possibility to travel and to learn in lots of different parts of the globe, which I very much appreciate.
Do you think that has resulted in an emphasis towards interdisciplinary work? And has made you more willing to go out into to go outside of your comfort zone into more of the university?
Yes, yeah, very definitely. And I think a lot of it goes back to my own program at Columbia University, because I was there from 1966 to 73 when I finished, and it was right after finishing 2 years of Peace Corps teaching in Nigeria. And in that period, I was able to put together a kind of personalized PhD program, very rare. It was interdisciplinary because I took double the number of PhD courses. You think I'm crazy, but I never regretted it, because I took courses in African history, art history, specializing in African stuff, and anthropology. And for a person who's interested in the arts, plural, and especially interested in the arts of Africa, you need to have each of those disciplinary lenses to bring to the table, because those arts happen not in isolated ways. They're not paintings on a wall in a museum. They're in people's bodies dancing at a festival, covered in costumes, wearing carved masks, singing songs. So you have all of those situations are multisensorial, multimedia events and happenings. And if you're not open to dealing with all of it, you're missing most of the powerful social impact of those arts. So, you know, masquerade has been at the center of much of my writing and research and work in Africa. And it was the combination of anthropology and history and art history at Columbia in all of those courses that made a difference in how I did my work. And one person was especially important to me, and that was Margaret Mead. She was my key mentor at a crucial point in my studies there. I had several mentors, David Scanlon too, and the folks in the art history department, Doug Fraser and Paul Wingert. These were all important people who shaped me and shaped my work. But Margaret Mead, especially because she taught a course in field work methods, and we did studies of the growing presence of artists taking over lofts in Manhattan, and I was the filmmaker for the team. And because I've been doing filmmaking ever since grad school, and that's part of my my work, because it's about performance. It's about performance. So that was kind of crucial. And so knowing my colleagues in those fields here at the university has also continued to inspire me and kept me thinking in multisensorial and multidisciplinary ways.
How do you emphasize that with your own students now?
Well, I try to give them a sense of the work that I'm that I do. I share that work with them, and I encourage them to engage personally in the work that they're researching with bodily engagement. So these extra credit projects that take them into the community is crucial, where they have to embody that that knowledge that they're gaining and share it with others and respond to those responses as well. In all of the PhD students that I have trained, I've tried to impart to them the kinds of field work approaches that I learned as a student and used in my work, so that all of the students that I have trained have done extensive field work in Africa with communities of artists and continue to be engaged with those communities. That's an important thing. I think it has been crucial to the strength of their own work.
How many PhD students do you think you've had now?
I have to stop and think, but I think it's about 7 or 8 now, and I'm finishing with 3 more, my final 3 students. You know, so I'll have about 10, 12 altogether. Mm-hmm. And I have quite a number of MA students that are out there too, but the PhDs, all of the PhD students have gone on to very successful careers and made major contributions.
Has the number of graduate students that the department's been able to bring in changed dramatically over the years you've been here?
It hasn't changed dramatically. There was a period when I had a very large number of graduate students. I think it was in the years 1993, 94, 95, 96, some in the mid-90s. I started here in 91, and once folks found out that I was here, then folks started to be in touch with me. Yeah, so I think 1 year I had something like, 7 or 8 grad students at the and PhD level. So we formed a little community within the art history department. That was only for that period of about 5 or 6 or 7 years as they went through. And then I've continued to have some students, but 1 or 2 at a time, maybe 3. As other African art, as other art history departments in other schools began to develop, they started, I started to have competition. And so folks were going elsewhere. And one of the problems, and this is a continuing problem for us, is the funding of graduate students. That's a major challenge for this university. There's insufficient funds to support graduate students. And that's gotten worse. And with the student loan crisis, it has become even more crucial. So the department has had to restrict the number of students that we would take each year so that we could be sure to fund them. And that was the only way we could attract them, because we're a highly regarded public university. That means we are competing with the most prestigious private institutions in this country. And many of our top candidates who wanted to come to study with us, in the end, had to say, no, I'm sorry, I can't come because Yale's giving me a 6-year package. Harvard's giving me a 5-year package. Emory's giving me a 6-year package. And so we would lose some of the best potential candidates. And that goes in for my field as well as all of the fields that my department has been strong in. So that's been disappointing, and it all goes back to graduate student funding, and that continues to be a challenge and for the university. But I still, had good, strong students. They came and worked with me and have gone on to successful careers. And I don't have any children. My students are my children. That's my family.
Have you found your mentorship style changing over time as you embrace this family, or that dynamic changing?
Yeah, it's grown deeper and stronger all the time. And now as I contemplate retirement, which is going to happen soon, we're looking back on that family history.
As far as undergrads go, do you think the relationship between staff and undergrads is strong within the department, or something that it could work on as far as bringing undergrads into the graduate?
I don't know if there's any major change in our relationship to undergraduates. I think in the last few years, it's been more difficult to attract students to an art history major because of economic factors and cost factors. I don't know if this is the case, but I sense that, even though I've not been a part of those conversations, parents are telling their students, well, you can go to University of Wisconsin-Madison, I'll help you pay tuition, but you have to take courses that are going to get you a job. And so the arts and humanities are seen as less saleable, less occupation-oriented, less job and salary certain. And there's been a major push in this university for the sciences. That's clear. And the arts and humanities have suffered because of that. So I haven't been happy with that that emphasis. I mean, I can understand, you know, wanting to encourage students in STEM areas, but we are for STEAM, not STEM. You got to put the A back in there for the arts, because arts is about creativity. It's about problem solving. Every artist is solving multiple problems in the process of creativity. And I think we undervalue it, and we need to value it seriously. Any good scientist is creative. That creativity is called science thinking, but it's actually artistic thinking as well. So I've been trying to, you know, in my work and to make people understand the importance of creative thinking and problem solving, and how artists are doing that all the time. That's crucial to their work, and that is also crucial to any activity, and actually to solving this society's problems and challenges.
Has this impacted what kind of classes you're teaching as far as seminar versus large lecture?
It hasn't really. I mean, we do both. One of the principles of shared work in both of my departments is that we teach one large lecture class and one upper division class a semester. That keeps us flexible. It keeps us on our toes.
How so?
In the sense that when you're doing an undergraduate large lecture course, back, you know, in the intro course, you have to get back to basics. And some of the questions and the comments that will come from the students are also about the basic principles and questions of the field or the material. And that's a good thing for us to be reminded of. You know, academics can get very focused on minutia, on the details of whatever they're thinking about or maybe writing about, and forget the larger issues that brought them to those specifics, right? Students have a way of reminding us about that. So with challenging questions. That's why I've always enjoyed the large lecture classes as much as my seminar advanced classes. Because the conversation takes place at different levels and keeps us flexible, keeps us fluid, keeps us engaged and thinking.
Have you been able to develop many courses or redevelop those entry courses based off of your thoughts on senseiotics and your own experiences?
I'm continually, you know, revising and rethinking the classes. I developed a certain corpus of classes from intro to upper level, and did that fairly early on, and I've stuck with that framework. I haven't been developing new permanent courses on specific topics, but I, you know, at the upper level, I have topics in African or African diaspora arts, which is open to what I'm dealing with at the moment. So the structure has been good. I have a core that I teach on a regular basis, and then I also have the flexibility of special topics courses. And as I've done more and more curatorial work, I've brought my students into that process in substantial ways. I mean, they become the curatorial team. We work as a team to put an exhibition together. And exhibitions and curatorial work is something that has always been a part of my career, but even more so in these last few years, because I'm less interested in writing so-called academic articles that go into publications that are seen only by other academics or people in my field. I'm much more interested in reaching out to broad, general audiences, the public. I consider myself an arts historian and a public humanist scholar. The public humanities are important to me because I want to reach and try to change minds on a much wider scale. So my students working in community is one of the ways I do it. The other way is by doing exhibitions that are open to a general public, where the writing and the knowledge that is communicated is pitched at a different level. It gets back to basic issues, basic concepts, basic ideas. Trying to have my Wisconsin or American students have a sense of what Africa and African people and African artists are about, what their lives are like, and how they're expressing the issues that shape their lives. That's been kind of the thrust of my teaching. So, in those courses, it's not just what happens in the classroom, but for a long time, I would organize field trips to Milwaukee and to Chicago with my classes, and we would go to the Art Institute of Chicago for the fine arts treatment of African art. Then we would go to the Field Museum of Natural History, the field which is an anthropological approach to that same material. And then we would go to a Haitian art gallery to meet with the woman who founded it and who sells African art. And we would go to Douglas Dawson, who had an African art gallery, high-end gallery, where they would get to see the material and hear him talk about it and get to touch the material and interact with it, which they couldn't do in any of those museum contexts. So these are the kinds of engagements that I would have my students do with the larger lecture classes. And with the upper division class, I developed and have taught over a number of years a popular course called Carnival Arts of the African Diaspora. So people would say to me, "Oh, you're a professor who goes to these carnival celebrations. Is that serious scholarship?" And of course it is. It is. I mean, they're just playing with me. They're not serious about it. But it was another way to engage students in something and to develop their own sense abilities, their bodily sense abilities, in addition to their intellectual or mindful abilities. So one of the carnival celebrations of the African diaspora that I would take these seminars to was Mardi Gras in New Orleans, which is just past.
This past Tuesday.
Yeah, and I was regretting the fact that I didn't have a class and was not in New Orleans with my students at Mardi Gras. And so we had a very successful trip one year, and it was a group of, 10 students in that seminar. And we focused on the African-American aspects of Mardi Gras, which is very distinctive. And it's coming out of a tradition of American apartheid, of Jim Crow separation, segregation. So there's a white Mardi Gras and there's a black Mardi Gras, and that's what I wanted them to understand and experience. And that was a great trip. And then one other time that I taught that course, we went not to New Orleans, but we went to Carnival in Puerto Rico. And those were wonderful experiences for them and for me. And it was a way of immersing them in those multi-sensorial experiences and seeing how rich they were and how transformative they were. That was important.
How difficult were those trips to organize?
They were not easy. They become more difficult now because of issues of safety and insurance and permissions and so on. But before that time, I could organize it, and they were complicated. But I had colleagues in New Orleans who helped me with those arrangements, and same thing in Puerto Rico. So it was my network of colleagues that helped to structure those trips, and they were seminar classes, so they were generally older, more mature students. They were, you know, MA students or PhD students, and some upper division undergrads, but people who were ready to engage. Those who came were the ones who said, "Yeah, that's what I want to do," and it was that kind of exchange that I think made the learning process go much deeper and was more rich.
Do you think the students that were attracted to these courses are a specific group or a wider group than your traditional art history class that maybe doesn't go on field trips or doesn't go to different institutional types?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, they came to my courses because they were interested in experiencing something different, something unusual. And maybe the reputation of my classes attracted them as well. But I always found them to be, you know, students who were willing to explore, to experiment, to take a chance. I think that's crucial. And I think that's an important part of the learning process. And teachers are ones who should encourage that kind of exploration of mind and body.
With it becoming more difficult to organize this style of trip, do you think that has restricted what you're trying to do as a professor, or have you had to go at it at a different way, a different style?
Well, I haven't tried to do those field trip seminars more recently, so I don't know. But I did propose one trip. And the processes of permissions and of insurance and of safety have started to come to the fore. I have to say that in all of the things that I love about this university, its size. Maybe it's the size, I don't know, but the administrative issues have become more complex and more bureaucratic and more daunting. I don't know whether it's litigious, I think that's the right term, the litigation possibilities in this society, that is, court, you know, cases and so on, have frightened institutions and caused them to respond by being self-protective. And being more protective has added to the bureaucratic steps that have to be taken before certain actions and certain programs can move forward. I think that's unfortunate. You know, I can understand the institution's point of view and perspective, but from my point of view, it's made experimental work and fuller engagement more difficult.
Has it made you utilize the museum space more?
Well, not anymore. I mean, I have used it extensively through all of the years. You know, when the new building was being built to turn it into the Chazen, I argued strongly for a space for a permanent gallery, and the director supported that. I got a space up in the upper, northeast corner. So it's not central where I would have liked it to be. So you have to find it. You have to want to go to it to find it. But we got a space, all right? So the issues of African art being marginalized or being seen as peripheral in the field of art history still continues to a certain degree, but we have a space. And I decided that this was going to be a project in which all of my students would become involved. And so it was not I who curated that space. It was two groups of students, two classes at a certain time. We started the process back, I think it was maybe in 2010, or maybe even in 2009, when I did a freshman course, a FIG course, a freshman interest course, specifically about the challenges, the possibilities, and the impossibilities of exhibiting African arts in a museum context. That was the theme, okay? And that was the first start of a conversation about, okay, we have this space, here's the collection, what do we choose, how we present it, what are we going to do in text, what are the kinds of things that we want to present in the gallery. And the students came up with a whole series of suggestions. They researched individual works, they helped select the final 52 or 53 that are in that space. That was the first step. And then I decided we needed to have another group of minds and bodies review and critique what that first group had done. So with some graduate students and again with undergraduates, we did a second course which finalized and refined the work of the first set of students with me. And that's what eventually determined the shape of the permanent gallery of African arts there, and I'm very pleased with it. I think people like it. It's unusual and a bit different from some of the other galleries because we decided that our label copy was going to say something about the history and the context of the objects. I was not just going to give the name of an artist or the medium that it was in or who donated it or the dimensions, that kind of thing, which is what we call a tombstone label. It's just basic fundamental information with nothing else. And we felt that history and cultural context and meanings, significance of an object are important for people to bridge those gaps between cultures and philosophies and ways of thinking and forms, visual forms. So that gallery has it. And we also have a video loop of some of my films, plus films from one of the students and some from colleagues that actually show some of the works that are in our collection in performance, in their original context, not the actual object, but ones that are of the same type, because I wanted to convey, and the students as well, wanted to convey the multisensorial context in which these silent objects under glass really lived. So, you know, I'm very happy with what we were able to do.
Were there any decisions that your students brought up that surprised you or you didn't agree with?
No, I don't think so. I think we were pretty much on the same page. And in fact, they were pushing us to to move in that direction and make it distinctive and different from other galleries, because that was often a complaint that, we go into these galleries, we don't have any information on which to evaluate what we're looking at. Let's provide some of that. Yeah. So no, I think we were pretty much on the same page, and in fact being pushed in the direction of a different kind of an approach.
Do you know how the Madison community, not just the UW, has responded to that exhibit?
Well, we hear, from visitors' comments and especially from the docents who teach and tour the various galleries with different groups, that they very much appreciate the African Gallery and the information that's provided there. Yeah, because I think that's an important thing. I know when I've brought exhibitions that I've curated, traveling exhibitions, I do the training for the docents, and that's an important, very important part of the process. But it's also something that I do and make available for the guards at the Chazen. Because the guards are the first people that people meet. They're the ones who are living with these objects, and I want them to know what they're working and living with on a daily basis. Because very often guests will ask them questions about it, so I want them knowledgeable as well. So I think that's an important part of the preparation and the impact of an exhibition. And to think about not just, other staff people or other academics, but the people who work in those spaces and live with the objects. They're just as important as communicators and people who can share information and need to be taken into the process.
Do you think the exhibit has drawn in new types of museum visitors because of the way the material is displayed and because of the information that
is available? I hope so. I don't know the specifics. I mean, I don't know how that's quantified. There are the guest books that people can make comments in, and I hear from my museum colleagues, but it's all kind of anecdotal, so we're not sure. I don't think we know. I think that we need better ways to know what kind of impact an exhibition has on people.
What are some of the traveling exhibitions that you've brought to Madison?
Well, the first one, which was the first major African exhibit at the Elvium, was in 1993. It was called African Reflections. And it had been curated by a colleague friend of mine. And it's all about the art of northeastern, what was then Zaire. So Mangbetu and Azande art from Central Africa. It was organized by the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. So it had an anthropological, ethnographic approach, but it had incredible works of art. So it had this wonderful balance of information about objects in their social and historical contexts, and related it to the history of those peoples and their interaction with non-Africans, visitors, because some of the forms, and they talk about it and show it in the exhibition, how they changed in response to the presence of Belgians or Europeans and American missionaries and so on. So it was an interesting, a very interesting, exhibition. And I brought a number of speakers who are experts on the various traditions of Central Africa. So, and we did an African dance festival and at the opening, and that was nice. And we had some local high school groups performing, step dancing and other kinds of dances, African-American groups. I'm trying to remember their names now. It's a while ago. But that was the first. That was the first. And that I did. And then I brought an exhibition that I curated called Beads, Body, and Soul, Art and Light in the Yoruba Universe. And this was all about the beaded arts of beading arts among the Yoruba people, both in Africa and in the diaspora, because Yoruba culture has had a major impact in the Americas. It's a huge culture, number maybe 35-40 million people today. And in the late 18th and throughout the 19th century, many Yoruba, because of warfare in West Africa, encouraged by the slave traders, many Yorubas were taken as war captives and sold into slavery and enslaved and carried to Cuba and Brazil primarily, but also Trinidad. And they came in large numbers, and they came late during that whole era, and therefore they were able to live together in large communities. They maintained their language, they maintained their social institutions, their religious practices, and their arts. So this exhibition traces the arts of beading and beaded objects from Yoruba land in West Africa to their manifestations in North America and Central and South America, especially Brazil and Cuba. So,
when was this exhibit?
That was in the, let's see, about 1998 maybe, and I have to look back on my resume to find out the date, but I brought it. It opened first at the Fowler Museum at UCLA in Los Angeles, where I have curated a number of exhibitions over the years, and it traveled to six or seven different cities, and I brought it to the LVM, to Madison, during its tour. And that one was very well received, and we had the opening, I remember, in the last week of January during the first week of classes. It was a terrible winter night, but we filled the museum, we filled the LVM. It was the biggest opening the museum had ever had. I think we had something like 1,200-1,400 people. And you know the Elvium building, the Page Court. Well, we had huge crowds, and we had a dance performance there, and a blessing and prayer, and the balcony all the way around, and the top level as well, filled with people. It was great. It was wonderful opening. And the show had a great run. We did lots of public programming, and in fact, we were awarded the Wisconsin Humanities Award for public programming that year. All of the public programming that surrounded Beads, Body, and Soul. And then the third exhibition that I brought was Mamiwata. And that was in, 2008, 9, something around there. And that also I curated for the Fowler. And it traveled to 5 or 6 different museums around the country, Stanford, and on the East Coast in Emory and other places. And that was also a wonderful experience. And we did lots of public programming. For both Beads, Body, and Soul, I think it was Beads, Body, and Soul, I did also community television programs that I put together that aired. WYOU was the community TV station here in Madison, and I did a series of 12 public programs with guest speakers that related to that exhibition, and did the same thing with the Mamiwata exhibition. The Mamiwata exhibition is arts for water spirits. Mamiwata being the most famous, mother of water. She's Pan-African and transatlantic, because there are folks who honor her in the Caribbean and South America and North America today. And for that exhibition, I collaborated with the Sea Grant program here on campus, because they're interested in issues of water, both Great Lakes and ocean issues, all things having to do with oceanic environmental matters. So they gave me a grant, and we had a whole series of lectures, starting with Patty Lowe, who was a faculty member here and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, speaking about the four lakes, the sacred lakes that surround us. And for our opening weekend, I orchestrated a boat regatta on Lake Mendota, because I sail. I had a sailboat. So I got Hoofers to donate, 8 sails that they no longer used. I gave them to 8 local artists. And each one of those artists painted a sail honoring Mami Wata and other water spirits. And we put those on the boats, and we did our regatta on the lake in front of the terrace for the opening of the exhibition.
That sounds amazing.
It was amazing. And you see, it's my friends and colleagues and this institution that got behind me and helped me, Sea Grant folks and Hoofer folks and museum folks.
How did you hear about the Sea Grant?
Well, I felt wonderful about it. I was they welcomed the idea. It was another vehicle for talking about serious environmental issues, and how these waters are sacred. They've been sacred to the original inhabitants of the land that we're on right now, the Ho-Chunk Nation. Those mounds are sited overlooking those sacred waters. That's where they gathered to renew themselves, to renew community, to renew their relationship to their environment. So Mami Wata was showing how African peoples also have that kind of symbiotic relationship to water, to sacred water. And it fit their vision, it fit my vision, and we worked together to produce this series of public programs about those matters. And that's what an exhibition can do. It can open up minds to all kinds of related issues. It's not just about the art objects, but it's about those objects as expressions of individual and community concerns, and how people are, thinking about the lives that they lead and how the arts express as well as reflect, and how those arts shape those ideas and shape community. And that's what this exhibition was about, and it was extended to the waters of Wisconsin.
Have any of the items from those exhibits come back to the Wisconsin collection or at the Chazen? Like those sails, for example?
Well, the sails, yes, they have. The artist gave me the sails after the regatta. I kept them for a few years in my garage, not knowing what to do with them. But I have a strong connection to the Madison Children's Museum through one of my former students. And this wonderful artist and person who does all of their design and helped to create that award-winning children's museum, Brenda Baker is her name. And I've worked with Brenda Baker and another former colleague here at the university, Willie Ney, when we developed a whole series of community collaborative programs between the university, the Madison Children's Museum, and the Madison Metropolitan School District. Those three institutions, Brenda, Willie, and I, got to work together to do a series of year-long programs looking at arts and culture in Latin America, essentially. So the first program we did was Viva Brasil, and that was, what, 95, 96. Then we followed it with a program called Sin Fronteras, Without Borders, that focused on Central America and Cuba. And then a third one that was a second rendition of Sin Fronteras that was also based on Central America. And that involved school programs and visiting artists and programs at the Children's Museum. Okay, so that's a whole other history that I can talk to you about later. But the point on this is those sales for the Mami Wate exhibition. The painted sales have now been donated to the Madison Children's Museum. They use them in their outdoor space, which is now being transformed. And they created a kind of canopy with those sales for kids to play under. All right. And the boat that I had, that I owned, that was part of the regatta, and also used to lead the Madison Children's Museum parades on Peace Day in the beginning of September. They used it as a float, and I would have kids, and the kids would have painted many. I have layers of children's painting on the body of my boat. That has now been donated to the Madison Children's Museum, so that my boat, its trailer, as well as all of these sails, are now used by the Children's Museum. Yeah. So it's come back to the community.
Has there ever been a problem with keeping memories or objects or non-objects for these exhibits as far as maintaining a group memory about them when something isn't necessarily materialistic?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, these exhibitions come and go. The objects come from various sources, lenders, institutions, and persons. And then after the tour of an exhibition, it goes back to their owners. And usually the tours don't last longer than 1 or 2 years because owners don't want to be without their art for long periods of time. There were some objects in the exhibition that were mine, that had been given to me as gifts or that I had purchased as part of that whole exhibition project. And those I've now donated to the Fowler, and I've given donations also to Chazen, and will be donating other works in the coming years. So they're around, but they're now scattered. They're not part of the project. There's the book, the catalog that went with the exhibition, that's still available. And I did, at the same time I did the catalog for the exhibition, I did a major edited volume that won the high publication prize for that year in my field, in the field of African art history. It's an edited volume, it's called Sacred Water. Sacred Waters, Arts for Mami Wate and Water Spirits in Africa and its Diasporas, or something like that. I think that's the title. 46 authors. It runs to something like 470 pages. It's a huge volume. When one of my colleagues who was the education curator at the Chazen, she saw when I brought her a copy of it, she said, "Boy, that book, that's heavy enough to sink Mommy's boat," because it was a huge volume. And in addition to the essays from these 46 authors, I included a DVD that has 500 other images that we couldn't publish in the book, but that were part of the essays. And it includes film clips of ceremonies and festivals and songs and some poetry, some spoken word as well. So It was my first effort to make a volume multisensorial. It's not just about words and pictures. It's about sounds, and it's about performance. And those are things that are part of that volume as well. So, and that's what I'm working on. Kind of multi-sensorial book now on Yoruba culture. So,
and visual and audio recordings have played a huge part in your personal research too.
Yeah, they have. The films have always been a part of it, and sound is, of course, crucial to that. I'm still trying to figure out ways to bring in taste and smell and touch, but, we'll figure it out.
Do you think using visual and audio came from your time in the Peace Corps or at Cleveland State, or also really came into its own at UW?
Well, it came into its own at UW, because I think the first time I wrote about it was in 1990, just in the year before I was coming. It was already percolating. But the source of this sensiotics, this approach I call sensiotics, the importance of multisensorial experience, goes back to when I was a Peace Corps teacher in Nigeria. Because I went there to teach French and English. That was my job, teaching in a secondary school. But as an undergraduate, I had done languages, and I had also done studio art, mostly painting, but some sculpture. I was interested in sculpture, and it did, I made things. When I got to Nigeria, and as my students taught me Yoruba, as I was teaching them French, I got to know my community. I made friends with a Yoruba sculptor, and I asked him if I could become his apprentice. And he agreed, and that changed my life. That was a transformative experience. I apprenticed under a master Yoruba sculptor for about 7 or 8 months, 1965 into 1966. And what I learned from that was that if I was going to have a deeper appreciation of Yoruba art, sculpture specifically, I had to try to make it myself. I had to embody that knowledge that my master possessed. And that apprenticeship was not verbal. It was about action. It was about embodying the ability to carve wood with an adze, the traditional carving tool that's used by Yoruba sculptors. And seeing the process of creativity was teaching me what he was looking for, what that image in his mind was that he was translating into three-dimensional wood sculpture. And if I could imitate that, if I could approach that and follow what he was doing, I would at least have some sense of the bodily wisdom and ability that he possessed as a Yoruba master sculptor that I could then embody myself and talk about from personal experience and knowledge. That was the source of sensiotics. That was the awakening. And it's what took me to African art history. I didn't know what I was going to do after the Peace Corps. I knew I was going to go back to grad school, and I wasn't quite sure what I would do, but African cultural studies I knew was going to be the heart of it, and it's what took me to the field of African art history. But always remembering arts, plural, and this whole bodily engagement, the importance of body, mind, because I understand us as creatures that have a unified system. We are both body and mind, and that the senses are the source of our beginning knowledge. We theorize, we think through our senses, We're responding to our sensory experiences. We're learning in that way through all of our lives. We have to recognize that and make that part of our scholarship. Does that make sense?
I think so. I think so. It's something that might have to be embraced and then thought about for several days, several years before it really sinks in as an experience.
Yeah. I mean, let me give you an example. For the Yoruba, I'm writing about 7 senses, not 5. Every culture organizes their sensorium in a different way. Inuit people dealing in an environment of ice and snow and cold and Arctic waters have myriad words for the different kinds of surface quality, snow qualities that are crucial to how they navigate their environment safely. As one example, okay? So the Yoruba have what I think are at least 7 senses that they are manipulating and thinking about. The 5 that we think about plus 2 others. One is the sense of motion. How important is it for us in moving through this world, and the way we move through the world is an expression of who we are, what our status is and position in society, and what we think about those individuals by a critical evaluation of how they move through the world and how they interact with us, okay? The Yoruba have a saying, Aiduro Ijoni, not standing still is dancing, okay? So any kind of motion is expressive of some kind of feeling or status. And they also have another saying that one should stretch out one's leg and let dance catch it. Dance has a presence. It has agency. Motion is what activates us. So when Yorubas are evaluating something, they're looking very carefully at how one dances in a ceremony, and is that motion appropriate to their status and position in society, or are they being overly egotistical in their movements? Are they being proud and arrogant in their motion? Or are they being humble and kind and gentle? All of those motions and the way they interact with people and move through space is taken and read or understood and incorporated into one's impression of a person and their personality and their attributes. That's for one example. So the sense of motion is important. And then the 7th sense is the sense of what we often call 6th sense. It's altered state of consciousness. It's that sense that we feel when we are in deep flow. People talk about being in flow here, where you, how can I explain this? Yeah. When you have those euphoric moments when everything seems to be in sync or in flow, and it takes you to a different place. It's, you know, we explain it to ourselves in different ways. We talk about, running for at least 35, 40 minutes when the endorphins kick in. You're a person who walks through wilderness environments. And I'm sure at a certain point in your wanderings, your brain waves change, your attitude changes. You're going into a different state of mind. You may not go into a trance, but you're going into something that is trance-like. That's what I'm talking about, what I'm calling suprasensory, not extrasensory, but suprasensory perception. And that altered state of consciousness is not produced by drugs. You know, it can be, but in a Yoruba context, religious practice takes you there, takes you to trance. It's expected for a ceremony to be successful. People go into altered states of consciousness where spiritual presence occupies them, which is no different from a Christian church where people start to speak in tongues. You know that expression? To get the Holy Ghost, that's an altered state of consciousness. And that's a place that we experience at certain special moments in our lives. And it's something we need to understand because we have that capacity, and there are cultural situations and cultural institutions that facilitate it in Yoruba culture, definitely. And it's part of religious belief and practice. And we have it, and I think it's universal. So that's kind of an example of what I'm talking about as the importance of sensory experience, and that it's happening with the interplay of all of those senses.
Has your style of research adjusted to this different mindset of different non-Western concepts of senses, of social interaction, or do you feel like you have adjusted with it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly every intercultural experience that I've had, whether with Yoruba people in Africa or Siddhi folks in India or Brazilians have shaped me, have changed me, have made me more sensitive, I think, to cultural difference and cultural similarity at a deeper level. And I think it manifests in my own behavior. I think I walk differently when I'm in Yoruba country. I know I speak differently. I adapt a kind of Nigerian English, partly because when I was a teacher, I wanted students to understand what I was saying. And Nigerians speak English in a very particular way. And there's a dialect called Pidgin English that also has its own grammar and its own vocabulary. And in certain situations, you need to use that. So voice and sound and bodily attitude and also proxemics, where how far or how close I stand to a person, how I greet them, how I look at them, how I might touch them in greeting and so on. All of those things are operating. And I think my sensiotics, what I talk about as sensiotics, is something that I'm seeing reflected in my own life and the kinds of changes that I go through in different kinds of cultural situations, to bridge those differences, to make people more comfortable with me and myself more comfortable with them as we engage and cross this cultural divide, if we think of it as a divide.
Would you consider that code switching?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, that's part of it. Yeah. And we talk about code switching mainly in language, but it's all of those other things as well. I mean, think about smell, bodily odor. Certain cultures mask it with certain kinds of perfumes and scents. Other cultures don't. And what does that cause in people's reactions to one another? You know, natural body odor from one climate might be seen as a lack of cleanliness in another context, and how does that affect our relationship and feeling about the other? You know, so the sense of smell is crucial. It's part of our the way we judge people as humans, right? As human animals.
You're recently back in Madison. Do you think there's going to be any shift that you have to take coming back to Madison, back to teaching, back to winter?
Oh, yeah, all of it is a shift. Well, I'm not back to teaching, so that's easier. But, the climate change is a big difference. From 100 degrees in Lagos and 100% humidity for the last, you know, because I've just come back from, almost 2 weeks in Lagos, Nigeria. It was an incredible experience because I hadn't been back there in a long time. But I went for this incredible event called Dance Gathering. It's a third annual event. This year it brought together about 85 performance artists from all over Nigeria, all over Africa, Europe, and Latin America and the United States. Incredible young artists who are using their bodies, their voices, their musical talents, and their poetry to create these incredible performances. And it was awe-inspiring. Oya Mileno, my mouth was open. I couldn't speak. They were so inspiring. This was happening in Lagos in the hot season. Well, there's no cold season in Lagos, but they were doing all of their rehearsals in Glover Memorial Hall. It's a big theater place. It's an old theater, and it's been turned over to Kudus Onikeku, the man, one of the organizers of this event, and for his dance company, and. You know, there wasn't much electricity, no air conditioning. And when 85 artists are performing and drumming and sweating and dancing, it became a sweat lodge. It became a sweat lodge for everyone. And it's a totalizing experience that you're feeling. Then to come back to sub-zero Wisconsin weather that's very dry because we use heat to make places livable. It's a complete change. It's changed my voice as well. Things were much more fluid in Nigeria. Things are more restrictive here.
As far as mental health, do you ever find it hard coming back to Wisconsin or the winter here?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Increasingly so. Yeah. I don't enjoy the winter. There have been times when, you know, I've tried to meet it and enjoy it and get into it, and I've been able to. It's not, you know, I survive. But the heat is, I need sun and I need heat. I know that I in the past have suffered from seasonal, what is it called? The SAD, seasonal affective disorder. So I have to figure out ways to deal with that. It's the warmth of my friends and colleagues and students here that keep me going.
Right. Does the department and school ever, have you felt like they support staff and students? Because it seems like a very prevalent, something that the whole community goes through.
Yeah. And it's an issue. It's a real issue. Because for those, and I think probably there are more people than we realize that are deeply psychologically and physically affected by climate and by winter. You know, I'm reading about us as human animals. Becoming Animal is one of the books I've been reading recently. And it reinforces all of the things I'm thinking about the senses, because we are animals. We are not very different from those other creatures. And I think what has happened, one of the things that contributes to the challenges of winter, is that as animals, we need hibernation time. It is for every other animal but us. You know, the winter season tends to sometimes activate and make more intense our social activities in galleries, in performances, in the school calendar. But it goes against, we're going against the climate that is telling us this is a time to be quiet, be inside, to hibernate, literally, figuratively hibernate, and refresh ourselves in preparation for the coming of spring. But we don't. We're going against that natural, what I think is a natural environmental and physical need. So that conflict, I think, affects certain people more than others. Doesn't stop us, but I think at some certain levels we feel it. And then there's the added stress that comes for both faculty and students at certain times in the semester, and we have to be very conscious of that. I think, you know, we all feel that stress, and students feel it, but faculty feel it as well. We feel kind of overwhelmed, and the deadlines start to build, and things become due, and we have to be supportive of each other during those times. I think the university's made a concerted effort to do that for, you know, the mental and physical health of folks as much as they can. But yeah, it's an issue.
Is there a favorite part of winter you have?
Well,
or something you do every year that resets?
Yeah, well, you know, I try to stay very active. I stay active. I go to many arts events, not just exhibitions, but lots of music. I love music. I love to go dancing. And I do that on a regular basis. I go to films because the arts inspire me. When I see really fine artistic presentations of one kind or another in various media, it inspires me in my own work. And it gives me ideas for my own writing and my own thinking and my own future projects. So I do that a lot, and that keeps me active. I have to try to stay physically active, because I know that for me, a balance between mind activity, writing, and sitting in front of a computer has to be balanced with physical activity. There's an Ojibwe prayer that I learned from a dear friend and colleague that is my mantra, and it goes like this. It's blessings and balance. Balance and blessings, for with balance come all blessings. Nina Sisse Gewin, we are all one family. That's a blessing that I like to give, my friends have gotten used to it, so whenever we're having a meal and a gathering or a wedding celebration or an engagement party or some kind of celebration, I get asked to recite it, and I love it, because to me that's important. Balance is crucial to everything that that we need, I think, in this in our lives. And to say that we are all one family is an assertion of my belief that we as humans share much more than what divides us. And that's always the message that I think we need to remember, especially in this country where race divides, the arbitrary difference in color divides and causes people to fear and to hate, and is the source of this country's continuing issues and problems that needs to be solved and recognized.
I feel that that's a really great closing comment, too. Is there anything else you'd like to state?
No, at this point, no.
Okay, excellent. Well, okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Joya Spanafora, and I am conducting the second interview with Professor Henry Druhl as part of the Art History at 100 Oral History Project. You previously mentioned the Mami Wata exhibition in 2002 and how non-UW, but still Madison institutions became involved with this project. Would you mind explaining a little bit more about the relationship that you formed with other museums in Madison, specifically the Children's Museum?
Yes. Well, you know that my position since I came has both been academic teaching, research publication, and also curating. And I've always wanted to do that, to balance the academic work with the curatorial work, reaching wider audiences through museum exhibitions and publications and public programs. So back in the 1990s, 96 I think it was, and 97, I worked collaboratively with a colleague here, Willie Ney, who was in Latin American and Iberian studies, and another dear colleague and friend, Brenda Baker, who was at the Madison Children's Museum. And we put together a series of public programs that involved visiting artists and public programs and educational programs in the schools and programs at the Children's Museum. That first one was called Viva Brasil, and we were focusing on bringing culture and history from Latin America, different parts of Latin America, to our community here in Madison. And we worked, the three of us worked collaboratively. It was the Madison Children's Museum, it was the Madison Metropolitan School District, and UW that were the three partners working in this community education and cultural affairs kind of arts and culture program. And we brought two wonderful artists from Brazil. One is a visual artist, Anita Sanchez, and one was a musician, Giba Conceição. And they had residencies in a number of elementary schools in the district. And we encouraged the schools to devote a certain amount of time to focus on Brazilian arts, culture, and history. And some of them took it so seriously that we turned them into what we call samba schools. A samba school in a Brazilian context is a community organization that parades during carnival time and also does other kinds of programs throughout the year. So we had at least three or four of the elementary schools who became samba schools, in which the students focused on Brazilian arts and culture, learning certain Brazilian dances, making costumes, carnival costumes and masks, and learning to play musical instruments from Brazil, being taught by these two visiting artists, one in visual arts, one in music. And it was a year-long program in the schools, although their residencies were not full year, but the students kept it up, and we had other visiting artists come to also introduce and demonstrate Brazilian culture. And at the end of the program, we created a samba parade, a carnival parade from the Capitol down State Street, in which all of the samba schools and the students performed, walking, dancing, riding, performing along the way. Some of the schools prepared floats that they decorated and then performed on. I remember one of the schools, and I think it was Lincoln that got so involved in it that one of the students had a father who owned a truck. They turned the truck into their float, and up on the top of the cab, they made a throne, and the principal of the school sat up on the top of the truck, waving to the admiring crowds as we came down to Library Mall. So this was the first in a series. We did another one a few years later with the same collaborative effort between University, Madison School District, and Children's Museum, that focused on Cuba, Cuban culture, and another one on Central American cultures. So there were themes and exhibitions that were prepared at the Children's Museum and special activities that focused on those countries and those areas of Latin America. And it was a project that I was very proud of and proud to be a part of. And we thought they were very successful because we were reaching thousands of elementary school kids as well as folks at the university who were seeing the activities that we were doing, and all the kids who were coming to the Madison Children's Museum. So that was one of the projects. As part of my work at the university and being adjunct curator of African art at the Chazen, I brought several exhibitions to the university. The first one, which was the first major African art exhibit, came in 1993, just 2 years after I came here. And it was an exhibition called African Reflections. And it was about the art of the Mangbetu and the Azande people of Central Africa. It was a major exhibition of arts and culture from those areas of Central Africa that had been done by the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. The curator of that exhibition was a good, a close colleague and friend of mine, and she was looking for venues to travel the exhibition, and I proposed what was then the Elrium. And the director supported it, and so we brought that exhibition to Madison. And did a series of public programs. These were experts on various aspects of Central African art history who came and gave talks, I think about six or seven of them, if I remember correctly. And then all of those presentations, lectures, we published in one of the bulletins of the Elbium Museum of Art. And so that was the start of what I have continued to do in bringing exhibitions, either ones that I curated or by curated by colleagues. So that first one in 93 was not curated by me, but it was one that I knew about and wanted to encourage its traveling here to Madison. And that that was very well received, being the first African art exhibition at the Elbium at that time. A few years later, I curated another exhibition for the Fowler Museum of UCLA. And that one I did with another colleague of mine, John Mason. And we entitled the exhibition that we curated Beads, Body, and Soul, Art and Light in a Yoruba Universe. And it was all about the beading traditions, the art beading traditions of Yoruba people from West Africa, where I have worked and lived for many years. And the Fowler had an excellent collection of beadwork from the Yarra, and that's when they invited me to be the guest curator. And then I invited John Mason, because John is also an artist and a priest in the Yarra religion as it's practiced in the United States. So our exhibition was both Africa and the African diaspora, or the Yarra diaspora. And that's been a constant in the work that I do. I'm always trying to connect what I know of Africa with African artistic traditions in the larger diaspora, whether North America or Caribbean or South America and other places as well. So that I brought that exhibition, and a smaller that one came to the LVM, and we had an elaborate series of public programs. It was these were lectures, they were performances, they were community events that we organized, a whole range of things. We did special kinds of tours for the exhibition as well. So it was a good, strong connection between UW and the Madison community, especially the school populations. And they had large numbers of student groups coming to see that exhibition. And it was the public programs for that exhibition, Beads, Body, and Soul, that won the Wisconsin Humanities Council Award for public programming that year. It was regarded as one of the finest humanities programs. So I was very happy about that. It was a great encouragement for me to think about doing the next one. And when Beads, Body, and Soul was at the Art Museum, I organized smaller collateral exhibitions by two artists. One was a colleague of mine at the time, Sonia Clark, and one of my PhD students, who is a Yarra himself, and they are both artists. Sonia works with beads and with textiles and with human hair in her work. She just gave a keynote address at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art just a few days ago. And we organized an exhibition of their work in one of the student-run galleries of Memorial Union. So we were involving the Arts Committee, run by students, in that project. They did a great job in installing it. And Sonia and Balaji came and spoke about their work as well. And then another exhibition that I did in another site and another space was called Joyful Blues. And it was an exhibition of indigo-dyed textiles, hand-painted and hand-dyed by Yoruba women, that were textiles from the Helen Louise Allen textile collection, as well as my own collection. And we held that one in the design gallery space in the old School of Human Ecology. So these are the spaces that I have used over the years, and as you may or may not know, I recently did another exhibition with my students in an exhibition creation course that we have in our department, called Whirling Return of the Ancestors, and it was an exhibition related to arts in honor of ancestors among the Yoruba, and we held that exhibition. My students put it together with me, so we were a committee of, 17, working on that exhibition, and we had that just this past year in the new design gallery space in the new Sohi building. And then the Mamiwata exhibition was another one that I brought. That's another exhibition that I guest curated for the Fowler Museum. I've done quite a few for them. And I've always wanted to bring them here to my students and to my colleagues and my community here. So both Beads, Body, and Soul and Mamiwata, Arts for Water Spirits in Africa and its Diasporas, was an exhibition that opened in Los Angeles. Both of these opened in Los Angeles, and then they had multiple venues. I think Beads, Body, and Soul went to 6 or 7, and Mamiwata Exhibition went to about 5 or 6 different major art museums and university museums across the country. So Chazen was one of the stops, and this is a project, Mamiwata has been a project I've worked on for a long time. Almost 35 years since I first met her and she first seduced me. You know, Mamiwata is mother of water, and she is a very powerful water divinity in West and Central and even East Africa. She's almost Pan-African. And elements of her have come to the Americas as well, to the diaspora. So it's a topic that's really has always intrigued me, and I wanted to put it together in the form of a traveling exhibition. So we borrowed pieces from the Fowler Museum's collection and from private collectors and from public institutions, and it was a major show that traveled many places. And when it came here, again, I did major public programming surrounding the exhibition. And we started with Patty Lowe, who was a colleague here at the university, and a wonderful representative of the indigenous people who first stepped foot on this land, the Ho-Chunk Nation and the Ojibwe people. And so she opened an extensive lecture series talking about the four lakes, sacred lakes that we live on, that we move around, reminding us about the importance of the sacredness of water. So that was the lead off to then a series of talks. And with the Mamiwata exhibition, I wanted to combine issues of arts and culture with the science of the environment and environmental issues. So I partnered with the Sea Grant unit here on campus, and they provided some speakers for a discussion about water issues, environmental issues, and I brought other speakers who are activists in environmental and climate change issues to talk about water here and in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes and global, on the global scale. So it was something that was, what was important to me was that arts and culture have messages that touch all aspects of our lives, and that arts are not separated from sciences, that the arts are reflecting on them, expressing them, talking about them, informing us about various issues. And I thought that the Mamiwata exhibition would be an excellent time to bring those water issues together with arts culture and show how important sacred water was in an African diaspora context. So that gives you something of the range of the exhibitions that I've done. And then when the new Chazen building was completed and we were planning the new gallery spaces, the director, Panchenko, gave me a gallery, a permanent gallery in the northeast corner of the building. And I leapt at the opportunity. And again, worked with my students with an exhibition, curating of an exhibition class, and actually did it over a 2-year period, because I did it 1 year with incoming freshmen as part of the FIG, Freshman Interest Group courses. Do you know about those? Well, these are special courses that are proposed that provide a cluster of 2 or 3 classes for incoming students in areas that might be of special interest to them. And so this one was to prepare the design and the concept of the gallery itself, And then to actually work to produce the research on the objects, help to choose them, write them up, and talk, make proposals on how they should be displayed and what the themes should be and so on. And the freshman interest group, the FIGs, usually they attract their young students, incoming students, but they're people who take initiative. And so it was a great group of really engaged students. And we produced a plan and we did the work, and that was in preparation for then the second year, when I had another group of students follow up on the work that had been done in the first one and to evaluate it, to critique it, to comment on it, and to improve it and enlarge it and deepen it, deepen that work of the first year students. And it was through that second curatorial class that we produced the final plan for that gallery. Everybody worked and researched the objects, helped decide the works, and we had one of my graduate students was a funded intern at the Chazen at the time, and he was also involved in the planning. And my colleague in Afro-American Studies, Frida Hayatesfagorgas, was part of it and helping and with elements of the project as well. And we put it together for the grand opening of the new Chazen. And I use that regularly in my teaching. And we produced a video that shows some of the masks in the collection that in performance in an African context, and talk about each of the objects with labels that are that are attempts to help direct the eyes and the thinking of the people who come to the gallery to visit the objects. It's not just a name and a medium and who donated the piece or, you know, what it's called, but we wanted to give cultural and historical context in a shortened, tight form, just so that people could come to evaluate and appreciate the objects in that larger context. And so that's what we've done in that exhibition space, in that gallery.
Because your position is, I believe, the first one that has a specific relationship to curatorial work with the museum.
Right.
Have you had to develop any sorts of best practices for how the department interacts with the Chazen?
Well, we've kind of done it individually on our own. Each of us, because I'm not the only one in the department who has curated exhibitions for the Chazen. And we have each gone to the director in the past and in the present as well to propose projects and to see how it would fit with their own schedule and plan and what spaces might be available. So we've done it over a long period of time. There's another exhibition that I forgot about to mention to you, but it was when I was building the African art collection. There was an earlier introduction of the developing African art collection that we did in the Mayer Gallery in the Elvium building. This was before the new extension was built. And that, again, was a course that researched and helped curate the exhibition. And that one was called Revealing Forms. And we produced a pamphlet. We produced an educational booklet for teachers to use. We prepared slides of key works in the collection. And that was kind of the first step that was preparatory to the then later one when the collection had even grown further, and that would go into this permanent gallery in the new Chazen building. So it's been a project. I mean, it's been an ongoing thing all along in the 28 years that I've been here. I and my colleagues we've continued to talk about those curatorial projects, but in the past, I think we pretty much worked on a one-to-one basis with the director had our own plan, either working with students, and almost always it's working with students, either in a formal class or gathering a group together in a seminar to produce it. And it relates to the strengths in the Chazen's collection and what they're interested in showing, and what my colleagues in art history are interested in presenting and making, turning into an exhibition. So I don't know how many will talk about it in these interviews, but I imagine that I have maybe about 5 or 6 colleagues in the department who at various times have done exhibitions with the Chazen. I think I've done the most, but others have done exhibitions as well. And I think it's been generally a very good and fruitful collaboration. I think the fact that we are in the same complex and that art history is there to support what the museum does with the research that we do, the publications and the curatorial work, I think has generally worked quite well. And I think it's unique and an important aspect of the strength of this department.
You mentioned also that your students often play a really big role in putting on these exhibitions.
Yes.
Do you think that's something that attracts, because the museum is right there, that attracts grad students?
I think it does. I think that's been a real draw to them. I know that they've been enthusiastic in having this kind of hands-on experience. We find that many of our graduate students are interested in museum careers more and more as positions in universities and colleges are getting tighter now, more difficult to locate. And it's really competitive. And the museum is a place where students can find an institution and create projects and work that reaches large audiences and can have an impact in communities. And I think that's what attracts them to it. And that's something that's a strength here.
Are the exhibitions, do they dovetail exactly with your own research, or are they more highlights from your research that have been chosen strategically because of time in the gallery that's available?
Well, as I look back on the ones that I've been telling you about, all of them relate to my work as an African and African diaspora arts historian. I have always felt that the quality of my teaching is improved if it's something that I'm working on and thinking about and interested in sharing with others as I'm thinking about the material. So while I have to cover a wide range of topics in my courses on topics that I have not done personal work on, when it comes to a seminar course or to an exhibition course, which is a more advanced level, and with a greater focus, the fact that I am committed and engaged in that material is something that I can enthusiastically and fully communicate to my students, and I think they appreciate that. And I think this engagement of a faculty member's research and thinking about topics, if it can come into the teaching, it improves both. Both our thinking about what we're doing, and because we're getting other people with other perspectives, students who are then thinking with us about that material, not thinking about it, but thinking with us. And I think that raises the conversation and deepens the knowledge that comes from the experience. And especially with the creation of these exhibitions, because students have to select a very narrow topic, usually one object or two objects, that they go in depth in researching. They find out that material, then they synthesize it, then they have to learn how to write it up. both for an academic audience, but even the greater challenge is really to make it understandable to a general educated audience, a public, not another academic. And that's training them to use language clearly and effectively and concisely, because that's what labeling is about. That's what a presentation of an exhibition does. And I think it's a crucial exercise for all our students, whether undergrads or graduate students.
I was wondering if you might describe your research a little bit, especially how it's changed while at UW.
Well, I would say that I have followed a variety of different topics that have interested me. I think you, from earlier interview that we've done, you know that I'm an arts with an S historian, not an art historian. That is, I'm interested in the performing arts, the ephemeral arts, as well as the visual arts. And in an African and an African diaspora context, those things happen all together. They're not separated. They're not isolated. So that has helped formulate for me this perspective of multimedia events and experiences, and taking that even further to multisensorial perspectives. So I think what I've tried to do is to develop that more comprehensive approach to sensorial experience to help us understand expressive culture, which is the arts. That's another way of talking about the arts. When we understand that movement and sound, music and atmosphere in a context, whether it's a ritual or a ceremony or a festival or a procession, whatever it is, that we need to keep thinking about the multisensorial experiences that we're having if we're going to understand those expressive arts, those expressive cultural forms at a deeper level. And so I think that's kind of been the direction that I've taken. In the beginning, it was more focused on strictly the visual arts in my earlier publications. But my first book, which came out of and was developed from the dissertation, was about a masking tradition that talks about dance and music and song and lyrics and text and costumes and carved masks, all of it. And that's kind of been the trajectory that I've taken. I can't say that I've had a specific agenda on certain topics that I had in mind from the beginning, or a plan. I think my plan has been an eclectic one. That is, I've gone from one project to another. When I've been invited to curate exhibitions, if it's something I think I know about and make a contribution to, I'll take it on. And that's the way it's happened with some of the exhibitions. And that happens also with publications. And as I've done field research in many parts of the diaspora, I've tried to bring the results of that to various publications. So, for an example, another exhibition that I brought to the campus, which I haven't yet mentioned because now they're coming back to me, involves an African diaspora that not too many people know about, and that is the African diaspora, or the African presence in South Asia, specifically India. And that those African communities in South Asia are the result of a related but very different history of enslavement, and actually non-enslavement, because there's a period when Africans are traveling from East Africa as merchants or as sailors, as individual, independent and free individuals between mainly Ethiopia and Somalia in the northeastern part of Africa, traveling across the Indian Ocean to South Asia, now Pakistan and India and Sri Lanka, for probably a millennia or more, okay? And then with the expansion of Islam, Africans become recruited. Some of the, you might call them enslaved, but there's a difference. It's more a patron-client relationship than it is a master-slave relationship. Africans are recruited into the armies of the sultans who are expanding into South Asia from Persia down into India and Pakistan. And they are recruited because they have reputations as fierce warriors, loyal, strong, powerful, thoughtful, and courageous warriors. So they get recruited into the armies that are then expanding these realms in South Asia. And because they're in the military, they have the possibility of rising through the ranks. Many of them become corporals, sergeants, corporals, captains, admirals of navies. They become prime ministers serving various sultans in the various sultanates of South Asia. And they then stay. And so there is this African presence in South Asia. Then there's another group that comes with the in beginning of the 16th century, early 1500s. And they're enslaved by the Portuguese and brought from East Africa and brought to Goa on the west coast of India. They don't come in large numbers, and there's not a plantation system. So they're living in urban centers. They're mainly working as domestic servants in the households of the Portuguese. But they escape bondage. They go into the interior mountains and forests of Western India, and they set up their independent communities. They free themselves, and they set up communities. And the descendants of those early Africans are the people that I met in the early 2000s when I first went to India. And I lived and worked with one of the communities there, and the women have this incredible tradition of patchwork quilts. They also have very interesting and unique musical traditions, but I focus more on the visual arts of these quilts. And out of that research work in India, I collected the quilts. We helped the women establish a cooperative where they were making the quilts for sale as well. And I organized some of the first exhibitions and gave talks and have written articles about this quilting tradition. And how it has helped to transform and empower these communities known as Siddhis. They're known as Siddhis. And I brought and curated an exhibition of the quilts for the original, the older design gallery space. And I called it Stitching History, but I've done that exhibition now in other places since that first one, and now I call it Soulful Stitching. So that's another example of a curatorial project that I've done here at the university to share with the larger community, and it's, it's an example of how wherever my research has taken me, I have found different topics that attract me, that interest me, that I want to learn about. I do the research, I collect the information, I do extensive interviews with people and documenting the work, and then either turn it into a publication or, in this case, as with other topics, this quilt exhibition, which now has traveled to 6 or 7 major institutions around the United States, and we've been able to raise lots of money for the cooperative with the sales of quilts, because we do both the exhibitions that brings an exhibition fee from the institution, as well as sales and from their stores when they're able to sell them.
A lot of your work seems to interact directly with other other humans or human subjects. Has the process for, especially with documenting religious activities and cultural practices, has there been a change in the process for getting those projects at the university level passed? I know anthropology has an IRB board. Is there like a similar component that art history follows?
Individual faculty have to have approval from the IRB board for their projects. For example, all of my graduate students who are also dealing with human subjects by interview and so on various topics and so on have to get their approval, and I'm the supervisor of that approval and of their projects. As it has turned out, the projects that I have done were done earlier on, before the IRB was set up and operating as it is now for faculty. So I've followed the guidelines that they have established in my own research with the communities that I interact with. But it's mainly formalized now through the work of my graduate students.
So granting consent for using this material in published books and papers has always been an expected component of your projects, but maybe not policed?
Yes. Yeah, that's what I would say. I mean, I've always respected the privacy and the desires of the people that I have worked with. There are certain topics that I would not publish because it was privileged information. But all of those things I have worked out with the people that I've worked with, so I know what is accessible and what should be kept private.
Has that changed with over the last 30 years how technology shares information, as far as like if you collect something in the 90s and are now trying to share it now, do you ever have to get back in contact with original people?
Well, wherever I can, I do, but it's becoming difficult. In some cases, and if there's a question, well, then I won't pursue it until I can either be sure from the arrangements that I made with them at the time, or in getting in touch with them, because there's a diviner priest that I just recently revisited after many years. I mean, he's come to the States as well, and I've seen him, but we've had our conversations, and that material and our conversations are things that I often cite in my articles. I send him copies of those. We talk now because he has his Facebook page, and we can talk by WhatsApp and see one another, and so it's interesting to see how the digital world and the internet has changed those possibilities of communication and connection that weren't possible in my earlier work. Because I've been doing that that early research goes back to the 70s and the 80s and 90s.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about the change in technology and how that's impacted how you do your field research?
Well, part of it is, The changing technology has been a real challenge because since I'm interested in the arts, I do lots of filming. I don't just do interviews and I don't just do photographs, I do filming. So you see sitting before you the embodiment of a world change of technology, where my first films in the 70s, in the early 70s and the late 60s was done with Super 8 film. That little stuff in those cameras. And then it was first it was black and white Super 8 or 8mm film. Then it was Super 8. Then it was Super 8 with sound, with this little mini magnetic tape glued to the side of the film. And I have some, and I've produced some films from that Super 8 sound footage that I did in the 1970 and 71. And then when I was able to use video, the first time I was able to use video wasn't until 1986. Because the video camera technology could work here before that time, but in an African climate, it wouldn't work because the tape would stick in a hot and a humid climate, which is where I was working. So it wasn't until 1986 that the video camera was able to operate in that context, and many Africans shifted from photography to video documentation of their events, and I became a videographer along with them, documenting festivals and family events and that kind of thing. So it went to half-inch tape. And then in the 70s, there was one trip when I carried a 16mm camera, along with a suitcase filled with dry cell batteries to keep it operating. And I traveled around on a small motorcycle with these loads, and I was filming in the Republic of Benin. And I'm working on some of that footage now with a grant, this Creative Arts Award that I recently received, to make these series of artful documentaries of events and ceremonies and arts that have changed dramatically since I first documented them. And now, of course, I'm using digital cameras, and those have started to get smaller. And now the smallest one is the one that isn't with me today. It's my iPhone 7S. And I do all of my filming on that, and now editing that. So it's been a challenge for me to keep up with the changing technology. The change to the digital world, both in the teaching and in my research, has been a real challenge, because I'm not very good with technology to begin with. I've tried to teach myself, but I haven't taken courses, I haven't systematically learned. And so at various times I've had my students, whether undergrads or graduate students who I hire as a PA or a research assistant, to instruct this Luddite standing or sitting here, because I need to know the basic steps, and I'm just trying to keep up with it. And but it's a challenge, it's a real challenge. I think also this whole shift to not a pressure, but this encouragement to shift from classroom instruction to online instruction is something that I'm not, I have very mixed feelings about. Because I think the one-to-one or the face-to-face conversations that happen around a seminar table or in a lecture hall can be really crucial for what gets taught, what gets learned, what gets understood. And online courses are creating that distance between instructor and students. There are They're developing ways to make those conversations maybe more effective. But I'm at a point in my career where to construct or create an online course would take another level of learning for me of the digital world and of those possibilities. I have considered thinking about blended courses, where it's both face-to-face meetings and it's also online exercises and conversations and discussions. And I think that might be possible, and I think more effective. But this change to the digital world has not been an easy transition for me, let me put it that way. I'm continuing to learn and keep up as best I can.
I was wondering, you've taken a couple of sabbaticals. Do you Yes. typically use that solely for research or for writing?
Both. It's mainly for research, because many of the sabbaticals I've had grants to support those sabbaticals. I've had a Guggenheim Fellowship, that was one. I've had 3 Fulbright fellowships now, mainly for research. In one case, it was in Brazil. I was doing some teaching. I taught one course, but it was mainly to do research on Afro-Brazilian arts and culture. But the other Fulbrights, and I've had NEH grants multiple times, and those have been strictly for research, that is collecting information, doing interviews, putting projects together in that way. And some of them, many of them have led, or parts of them have led to the various exhibitions and the publications that I've done.
Is it ever an issue when you are gone from the department with other, are there other professors who are able to fill your topic, or temporary visiting professors?
That's been difficult because of budgetary issues. And so for the most of the times that I've been away on sabbatical, my classes are not taught during that time. But in one instance, they did have someone teach my intro course, and that was my one of my PhD students, who's finishing up now. And she did an excellent job. And I've had, and in the past, I think over the 28 years, I've had at least 3 or 4 of my PhD students teaching either my courses or special topics courses in African and African diaspora art history at various times. But it's not a given. And as budgets have gotten even tighter, it's become more and more difficult. So we can't count on that. We put in proposals for visiting lecturers or scholars or lectureships for our graduate students, but very often we're turned down, and that's unfortunate. Because I think the teaching experience is a great benefit to the graduate students if they've had, fully charge, full charge of a class, of conceptualizing it, of deciding on the readings, of how to structure it, and the images and the ideas that they're going to be presenting to the students right from the beginning. I think that's an invaluable experience and is going to help them in their first positions, which is very different from a TA position. So it's something that I've always fought for, but very often the funds haven't been there to support it.
Has the use of funds changed dramatically over the entire course of your career, or mostly in the last decade?
I would say in the last maybe 5 to 10 years, it's become more and more of an issue. I would say over a longer period of time, the main challenge has been funding for graduate students. In art, that's a key issue for our department. we're not able to offer the kinds of packages that private universities can offer. So we have every year lost our top candidates, some of our top candidates. Some still choose to come here because they know the person they want to work with, they know the strengths that we have, they know this relationship between art history and the museum, and the incredible resources of this university and reputation. It is a tier one research institution with incredible resources and incredible personnel. So despite the fact that a student gets a much smaller package or fewer years of financial support, they'll come. And then we work hard to find them positions during their tenure here, but it's often, you know, it's work. It's not, they can't spend full time just on their coursework and their writing and their research. They have to also work part time. So it's a challenge. And funding graduate students should be a very high priority for the whole university, because we're, I think, it's not just our department, but it's many departments that lose their top candidates because they cannot provide 5 to 6 year packages for graduate students.
Have you seen any funding issues in the faculty itself as far as the size of the department growing or contracting?
Well, that's always been an issue too. And as you know, as the university has to adopt this kind of business model, and things are dependent upon enrollments, numbers, FTEs, and so on, that's become a real challenge for us. And especially in the last few years, where there's been this emphasis upon STEM areas of the sciences, rather than the arts and the humanities. And I think the general economic malaise in this country, and now political malaise that we're going through, is forcing people to think more about careers than about learning, unfortunately. And so that certain majors and certain areas of study are seen as a luxury rather than important. And arts and humanities, I think, have begun to suffer as a result of that. I think it's also linked to this student loan crisis, which is an enormous problem for so many students. And what I imagine, I don't know of specific instances, but what I imagine is that when parents are talking to their children who have now been accepted to a university or a college, they're saying, you have to take classes that are going to help you get a job. And so you can't take art courses, you can't take art history courses, you can't take a music course, you can't take a philosophy course, because how is that going to get you a job? These are the conversations I imagine. And students are being pressured and encouraged to think in a more career-oriented way, rather than thinking about higher education as a way for them to develop themselves as mature individuals and knowledgeable citizens in a democracy. I think the liberal arts is crucial to critical thinking, to debate, to understanding social issues, economic issues, political issues, religious issues. And in the absence of that, this country is going to suffer. So I think the quality and the breadth of education at the higher level and at the lower levels as well is crucial to the survival of this nation.
What has the department been doing to kind of combat these issues?
Well, we've been trying to think of catchier titles for our courses.
Does that work?
Well, I think it has. Maybe it has. I don't know. I don't know if we've ever gotten any response from students to find out, did you sign up for it because you like the title? How about a title like Arts and Farts? That might catch somebody. Who knows? I don't know. But we've tried. Actually, I would have to say that in a sense, the titles that and the content that we're giving in our classes is an attempt to reach a broader audience where they are, to bring them along on a topic. So we're trying to think about how to broaden the message. And in fact, this is the kind of work that the curatorial work does at the other end. And, you know, it's putting together an exhibition that is going to reach a broad audience, not alienate them, not isolate them, challenge them. Well, challenge them in certain ways, but challenge them with ideas that are accessible and arts that are accessible. So I think it's this attempt at bridging a kind of communication gap between where undergraduate incoming students are and where faculty are in their research and the issues that they're dealing with is something that we're trying to address as best we can.
So has the size of the department changed dramatically?
It hasn't changed dramatically. We've been around 10 to 15 in that range for a while. It's grown a little bit, and it's, you know, changed with the coming and going of different faculty. I would have hoped, you know, that we could have hired more people in more areas and strengthened the global reach of our topics. We've done it to a pretty good extent. I think that's one of the things that, you know, I have appreciated about this department, that kind of commitment to a kind of global view of art making, and I think that's a very important thing. But I think we could do more in that direction. And we're limited because of budgetary matters. We're not able to hire because our enrollments don't justify additional lines in the department.
Because the department's relatively small, do you think that impacts the amount of service expectations for each professor?
Well, to a certain extent, I think we seem to have managed service. I have served on a variety of committees over the years, but I've put my main emphasis on my research and my teaching. But I think I've been a good citizen, but I haven't taken on, you know, a major position like being chair. I was chair of my department in my previous institution. And I have to tell you that after 3 years of doing it, I said I would never do it again.
And you stuck to it?
And I stuck to it. But I've tried to help the department wherever I could and serve conscientiously on various committees, admissions and financial aid. I've been the coordinator for our departmental colloquium for quite a few years now. I like that. I like bringing in people who are from outside the department, but whose work relates to the visual arts or visual culture, material culture broadly. And those have been great presentations. So, and faculty, it's a forum for our own faculty to test ideas and work that they're preparing, or lectures, or, you know, conference papers that they're preparing. So
I like doing that a lot. And it also gives opportunities for some of our advanced graduate students also to test the waters in a safe environment within the department. So the colloquium has been something that I've worked on and continue to work on. And I do that with the curatorial studies colloquium, which I'll be teaching in the fall. Bringing in curators, gallery directors, museum directors, others in the visual arts to come and talk about what they do and how they do it and so on, both here in Madison and I'll have some speakers probably coming from other parts of the country. Yeah.
The department will be turning 100 pretty mm-hmm. soon, just yeah. a few years. Are there any strengths that you hope it will continue to practice in the next 100?
Well, certainly the global reach and coverage within the department, I hope that continues. I think I admire my colleagues greatly for the kind of work that they do in the writing that they do, the research that they do, the teaching that they do. And a good number of my colleagues have a real impact on the field at large. You know, they run major programs like Cahill, Nick Cahill, who has the Sardis program in Turkey, and it's all about the classical world of the Mediterranean. And as part of that, he has an international presence in shaping those classical studies. And my other colleagues in their fields are also have national and international reputations. So I hope that the strengths that have always been here will continue to broaden and deepen and get even stronger, and that this department is recognized with a high ranking for the kind of work that it's done. I think being in a public university is crucial. I've always felt that that's where I wanted to make my impact. I think in the ranking systems, private institutions are given preferences for certain kinds of judgments, and that affects the ranking. I think our department has always been strong and will continue to be strong and will rank high among art history departments across the nation.
You've previously mentioned that you plan to retire soon.
Yes.
Do you expect that the department will be able to fill your position with another professor who focuses in African and African diaspora arts?
Well, I hope very much that that will be the case. But there are no guarantees, unfortunately. I was hoping that there could be something more firm and coming, but I think it's kind of out of my hands and it's out of the hands of the department. It will depend on how budget matters work and funding, I think, fundraising, because every department is in the effort of trying to fund. And I'm trying to contribute to that. We're just had a conversation about funding approaches to people to raise funds to support a position in African and African diaspora art. And because my appointment was a joint effort between Afro-American Studies and Art History, I hope that that will continue in the future as well. And I think that bodes well, the collaboration between the two departments. And it offers us other options, various ways in which we could put together this area, which I think is an important area to be maintained. So I hope that it will happen, and I'm working in whatever way I can to make it happen, but it's an uncertain future at the moment.
Have you had to do anything as far as planning for the effectiveness of the gallery if there isn't an Africanist on staff?
No. Nope, I haven't. It's a good question. And I'm talking with Amy Gilman, the new director of the museum. I'm still trying to make some acquisitions for the collection. I think, and in the coming months before I retire, that will be a conversation that I'll have with her. Because all of these years that I've been here at the university, my adjunct curatorial position was a more informal one made between the director and me coming and the departments, Afro-Am and Art History. He was agreeable to it, and I wanted it to be part of my my position here, that I would be able to do things for the museum, build the collection, and curate exhibitions, and he says supported it. Amy Gilman does not have funds to hire an African curator, and it's not a major part of their collection, so I don't think that's going to happen. But I hope that she would support whoever succeeds me. If they wanted to do exhibitions and work with the museum, that she would welcome that, and I think she will. But we're trying to work out my adjunct position, because I've done that in addition to everything else that I've done, the teaching and the research. There's been no pay, there's no salary for that work, so that's all been in addition to what I normally do as a faculty member.
Have you noticed with your other colleagues who have retired, as far as setting goals for a positive retirement, if they stay in contact with the department, or have you noticed anything that you've wanted to emulate?
Yes, they come to some of the events. I will do that while I'm still in Madison, but I probably won't be for that long. I'll be moving back to the East Coast, where my family is and my wife is, and so on. I am applying. I have requested emeritus status. I intend to continue to research and write and make my artful documentaries with support from the university. And I want to maintain that connection with the institution into the future. So I may be doing it from a distance, but hopefully coming back to visit periodically and attend department events and support whatever way I can. And I'm seeing that in colleagues who are still in town who have retired from the department. Both Gail Geiger and Susie Banger come to events when they are on topics that are of interest to them, and they're keeping tabs on how the department is doing. Which is good. I like their presence. And I'll do that myself. And we'll see. We'll see, what direction the department takes if and when they begin to work to replace me and find somebody to teach in this area. I'll be giving them advice from my network of colleagues and their students and others who would be a good fit and would be excellent people to continue the teaching here.
Excellent. Well, we've come to the end of our time. I just wanted to make sure if you had any parting thoughts or any other thing you wanted to discuss.
Nope, I don't think so.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.